I'd like to start out with a personal remembrance that is intertwined with the history of this country and the world. On February 27, 1968, I sat in a small room on Capitol Hill. It was a hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And there were six members of that committee seated around a long table questioning a representative of the administration. And I remember in particular the raspy voice of one of those senators. And he insistently demanded to know how long the Pentagon would continue to massacre people in Southeast Asia. Moments before the hearing adjourned, he said that he did not, and I quote here, intend to put the blood of this war on my hands, unquote. February 27, 1968. His name was Wayne Morse. He was one of two members of the U.S. Senate who, in August of 1964, refused to vote for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that came as near as anything else to being a declaration of war and amounted to a blank check that was to be refunded with untold quantities of human lives. But at the time, whether 1964 or 1968, Senator Morse was a bit extraordinary. Definitely extraordinary in terms of the House and Senate of the United States, and extraordinary in terms of the media environment of his times. Because he didn't simply denounce the war in Vietnam because it might be unwinnable. But whether it was winnable or not, he denounced it as unethical, immoral, and unconscionable. Here we are in the last weeks of 2001, and there's a great air of triumph in the news media and in the political atmosphere of the country, what we could call triumphalism. We're being told that the U.S. policy is vindicated because of military success, which is an interesting ethical precept. And when the other night I tuned in, as I do, it's not a pleasant job, but some people have to do it, to watch CNN, I saw a wide-ranging debate between essentially pundits who felt that it was enough to drop huge quantities of bombs on Afghanistan, and others who felt that it would only be right to go ahead and bomb Iraq. This is what's called a wide-ranging debate in the mass media. And I thought at that time back to some of the things that Wayne Morse had said, and I've gone back to some transcripts and so forth, and back in 1964, he went on national television. This is something he said, and I'm quoting. I don't know why we think just because we're mighty that we have the right to try to substitute might for right. And that's the American policy in Southeast Asia, just as unsound when we do it as when Russia does it, unquote. And I find some unpleasant irony in that statement as well. I've been on some radio and TV talk shows in the last couple of months, and sometimes there are calls in saying one way or another, sometimes in these words, sometimes in similar words. People like you are weakening our country at a time when we need to be unified, disrupting the kind of news coverage that we need to be supportive of our national family acting together to fight terrorism. And my response is that there are other models for how to cover a war in Afghanistan where the troops of one's own country is essentially invaded. I did some reporting from Moscow and Leningrad in 1986 and 1987, and I can remember that they had a very clear model for how to cover the Soviet troops being in Afghanistan, which was to simply have no debate at all, no dissent in the mass media at all, simply have the news media serving as stenography services for those in power in that country, running that government. And when you scratch below the surface of some of the complaints today, because 99.5% just won't do, some people want 100% U.S. government propaganda flowing through the mass media, you scratch the surface and you find that what they're really saying is any dissent is unacceptable. Debate is counterproductive. Democracy must be jettisoned on behalf of a foreign policy that should, particularly in times of war, stop at the water's edge, etc., etc. And there's, you know, when you go beyond the platitudes, and the platitudes don't really account for very much at all, it's when push comes to shove and people's lives are at stake and you see how institutions function and what kind of pressures are brought to bear. And again, I go back to what Wayne Morris had to say in 1964, when millions, literally millions of lives could have been saved. In retrospect, we know that to be the case. If we had had functional democratic debate instead of de facto, what we could call the dictatorship of the propagandariat. And, of course, we have the trappings of wide-ranging media discourse, but what Morse said in 1964 is as controversial, as difficult to get through the media grid, was as difficult then as it is today. Here's what he said. He was on Face the Nation on CBS, and a journalist named Peter Lisagor was arguing with Senator Morse, who, as I mentioned, stood almost alone on Capitol Hill. Lisagor said, and again this is from transcript, "Senator, the Constitution gives to the President of the United States the sole responsibility for the conduct of foreign policy." Wayne Morris broke in. He said this, "Couldn't be more wrong. You couldn't make a more unsound legal statement than the one you just made. This is the promulgation of an old fallacy that foreign policy belongs to the President of the United States. That's nonsense." Lisagor, "To whom does it belong then, Senator?" Morse, "It belongs to the American people, and I am pleading that the American people be given the facts about foreign policy." Lisagor, "You know, Senator, that the American people cannot formulate and execute foreign policy." Morse, "Why do you say that? I have complete faith in the ability of the American people to follow the facts if you'll give them. And my charge against my government is we're not giving the American people the facts." Well, here we are, a couple of months or so after we stared at the TV screens with incredulity, trying to comprehend the suffering of people who had been victimized by terrorism in New York. What we saw was ghastly. It was all too real. We saw the images and a window into the reality of the suffering and the anguish and the sorrow. At the same time, almost immediately, we began to witness an onslaught of media deception. Aldous Huxley observed a long time ago, "The greatest triumphs of propaganda have been accomplished not by doing something, but by refraining from doing. Great is truth, but still greater from a practical point of view is silence about truth." As a general said at the Pentagon to a reporter at the end of the Gulf War in 1991, "We lie by not telling you things." And that is an operational precept for much of the mass media as well. Within a couple of hours of the World Trade Center towers coming down on that terrible morning, morning of September 11th, I was watching ABC News, and right next to Peter Jennings was an ABC News analyst named Vincent Canestrero. And he helped put this horrific terroristic event into perspective for millions of people watching ABC News. What ABC didn't tell those of us watching is that Canestrero is a former high-ranking official of the Central Intelligence Agency who was in charge of the CIA's work with the Contras in Nicaragua during the early 1980s. In 1984, he moved to the National Security Council, where he became a supervisor of covert aid to the Mujahideen guerrillas in Afghanistan. In other words, Canestrero has a long history of assisting terrorists. First, the Contra soldiers who routinely killed Nicaraguan civilians, then the rebels in Afghanistan, like, this name may ring a bell, Osama bin Laden. So how can a longtime associate of terrorists now be credibly denouncing terrorism? It's easy. All that's required is for media to maintain silence, to remain in a kind of history-free zone that has no use for any facets of reality that aren't presently convenient to acknowledge. In George Orwell's book 1984, there's a description of these kind of mental dynamics. Quote, "The process has to be conscious or it would not be carried out with sufficient precision, but it also has to be unconscious, or it would bring with it a feeling of falsity and hence of guilt. To tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then, when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion for just so long as it is needed. To deny the existence of objective reality, and all the while to take account of the reality which one denies, all this is indisputably necessary," unquote. And indeed, it is indisputably necessary. So when Secretary of State Colin Powell on September 11th denounced, quote, "people who feel that with the destruction of buildings, with the murder of people, they can somehow achieve a political purpose," unquote, he was describing the terrorists who had struck this country only hours earlier, but he was also aptly describing a long line of top officials in Washington. It would be very unusual, almost unprecedented, to hear a comment, an observation of that sort from, say, an American pundit on any major TV network in the United States. But let's try to be very real about this. U.S. policymakers of the United States government have certainly believed, to use Colin Powell's words, that they could achieve a political purpose with the destruction of buildings, with the murder of people, when launching missiles at Baghdad or Belgrade. But we're supposed to pretend we don't notice. We're supposed to participate in a media propaganda process that infantilizes us so that we have to ask for permission to notice. There's been some talk, of course, about a clash of civilizations globally. And I think of a story that's told of a reporter who asks Mr. Gandhi, "What do you think of Western civilization?" And Gandhi replied, "I think it would be a good idea." We have, of course, the power to enforce not only through the news media the concept that might makes right, but also to define what is retaliation and what is terrorism. And of course, once those terms are locked in, then we have the white hats and the black hats, or, as was announced soon after the attacks on September 11th, the battle versus good and evil. So just take an example here. In August of 1998, 13 U.S. cruise missiles were fired at the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical plant in Khartoum, Sudan. That was an attack that, by hitting its target, deprived an impoverished country of desperately needed medical drugs. It was an atrocity by any humanitarian measure. In the words of political analyst Noam Chomsky, it was an action that, quote, with no credible pretext, destroyed half of the country's pharmaceutical supplies, probably killing tens of thousands of people, unquote. Why the probably? Well, nobody knows for sure the exact number, because the U.S. government blocked an inquiry at the United Nations, and it wasn't pursued. Only some, and this is part of the de facto U.S. media catechism, only some cruelties merit the spotlight, only some victims deserve empathy, only some crimes against humanity are worth our tears, only some crimes against humanity can even be acknowledged as such. Today, the victims of terrorism in America deserve our deep compassion. So, however, unauthorized by U.S. media, do faraway victims of the U.S. government, even though their humanity goes unrecognized by the U.S. media. But I think that the problems are so fundamental to U.S. media that it's not simply a matter of coverage of a crisis. I went back and looked at Time magazine the week before September 11th, dated September 10th, out the week before, the year 2001. Time magazine did a cover story on the Secretary of State of this nation, and this was a statement in the article by Time magazine itself, in the voice, the reportorial voice. Quote, the U.S. is at one of those fortunate and rare moments in history when it can shape the world, unquote. As long as that kind of attitude is in place, then I think we're going to have a succession of disasters. But to challenge that attitude means that we would require a fourth estate, not a fourth branch of government. We would require journalism that is independent, assertive, relying on a multiplicity of sources, not the kind of stenography to power, the obsequious government bootlicking imitation of journalism that we get from our most esteemed mass media journalists, which is to say mass media journalists praised by other mass media journalists. It's a pretty good system. And in that process, it requires going beyond the cliches. You know, a lot of the most praised so-called investigative journalists are simply the ones in Washington who have develop the best access to sources and the power structure. And how have they been able to develop and maintain those kind of sources, that kind of access? Well, they've not disappointed those sources that they've cultivated. And so it begins to be and continues to be a kind of a court press, not in basketball terms, but in political terms. The president and his appointees, kind of the king and the princes, and then you have the courtiers, the journalists, who are in this kind of a mutually advantageous relationship, and we call them great investigative reporters, and you can see them on the Washington Week in Review, and CNN, and Fox News Channel, and so forth. In that context, especially when the commander-in-chief has decided it's time to go to war, then you have only a spectrum of exactly how to pursue that war. I mean, the classic example was a few weeks into the Gulf War in early 1991, and I was watching the NewsHour, which was then the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour, now the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and Jim Lehrer said, and now we're going to hear from a panel of four commentators wide-ranging views, and I'm watching thinking, good, finally. And then he finished the sentence and said, we're going to hear from this panel wide-ranging views on when to start the groundwork. I think that kind of epitomizes it. So you have out from there the kind of spectrum of national security media commentators. Then you move out to the more far out, although these days they're considered to be virtually mainstream, people like Bill O'Reilly on Fox News Channel, who said soon after the events of September 11th, quote, the U.S. should bomb the Afghan infrastructure to rubble, the airport, the power plants, their waste facilities, and the roads, unquote. What about the civilian population of Afghanistan? Quote, we should not target civilians, but if they don't rise up against this criminal government, they starve, period. For good measure, O'Reilly urged the U.S. to extensively bomb Iraq and Libya. They call it the hotheads under hot lights syndrome. Then there's the former executive editor of the New York Times, A.M. Rosenthal, who topped O'Reilly in the armchair militarism department. He added to the list Iran, Syria, and Sudan. They were also expendable nations. Writing in his column in the Washington Times and a New York daily newspaper, not the New York Times, but another daily, that the U.S. government should be ready and willing to deliver a 72-hour ultimatum to six governments, kind of a bidding war, you know, how macho can we be? Six governments, 72-hour ultimatum, quickly followed by massive bombing if Washington is not satisfied. A couple other examples. New York Post columnist Steve Dunleavy demanded oceans of innocent blood, writing, as for cities or countries that host these worms, bomb them into basketball courts, unquote. The editor of National Review, a young guy named Rich Lowry, said, quote, if we flatten part of Damascus or Tehran or whatever it takes, that is part of the solution, unquote. You may remember in mid-September, Dan Rather attracted some attention. He went on the Dave Letterman show. Did anybody here see that? And the big buzz afterwards was that he cried on national TV, live and spontaneously. And that was, you know, was that good, was that bad? I think that was kind of good myself. But what wasn't controversial about his appearance is the following that Dan Rather, the CBS News anchorman, Dan Rather said, quote, George Bush is the president. He makes the decisions. Unquote, and Rather went on to say, speaking as one American, wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where, and he'll make the call, unquote. How's that for independent journalism?